morning. My name is Deborah Kroll. My family name is Utasia. I am an enrolled member of the Hakalome or Halong Salina tribe from the Central California coast. These days, I am a suburban Indian because I live in Phoenix. I have a mortgage and an SUV. I also am one of the Indigenous Affairs reporters at the Arizona Republic, where my beat is my fellow Indians. And I do a lot of environmental reporting. I've been doing environmental reporting for close to 25 years now. And welcome to our panel on Indigenous reporting, how to do it, how not to do it, and some really good tips for the majority of journalists who are not Native who would like to learn how to report more effectively in Indian country. So, without ado, our first speaker today is Christina Azapar, who's a journalism professor. She's going to introduce herself, and she's gonna give us some pearls of wisdom.
Hopefully there'll be pearls of wisdom. Hello, everybody. Ngapo. My name is Christina Azapar. I'm a citizen of the Upper Mountain Tribe, which is
Crow-Bed off.
Hello, hello. Hello, very. I'll just eat the microphone down here.
So again, Awingabo, my name is Christina Azokar. I'm a professor of journalism at San Francisco State University, and I'm a citizen of the Upper Mattapani tribe, which is currently occupied by the state of Virginia. And first, I want to thank the Wilderness for inviting me here today and for giving me the opportunity to talk a little about what's happening in journalism schools. It's actually not happening in journalism schools. It's a bigger picture. I'm the author of News Media and the Indigenous Fight for Federal Recognition. I brought copies of my book that I paid for myself, so I do not get any royalties off them, but I want them available. I will sell them at my cost today. If you want to buy one and you were willing to pay over the $50 fee, Venmo, PayPal, those extra funds will go to the intertribal group here on campus, the student group. It's called the intertribal student group or something like that. So I'm happy to do that. And the reason I brought it is because everything that I'm talking about today has to do with federal recognition, right? So a lot of when I was a journalism professor, I was doing research and trying to figure out what it is about the media and coverage of federal recognition, but there always seems to be a casino in the mix. And so I started doing research about federal recognition and news coverage, and there wasn't any. There was maybe three or four papers, and so I'm gonna write the book so I can educate journalists and journalism educators about the federal recognition process and the importance of journalists being able to cover the federal recognition process in an informed way. And one of the things that I was looking at, because I'm supposed to be talking about education and what's happening, they've asked me to talk about what was happening in journalism school, is there are no courses on Indian law and federal recognition and news media, right? So if anybody out there who comes from journalism school, has anybody ever taken a class in federal recognition and news media and covering tribes? Exactly. So that's a huge problem, because that means that professional journalists come into the profession without knowing any of the information, so it's always playing catch up. There's only one course actually offered, and it's taught by Patty Lowe at Northwestern University, but she's retiring. This is her last semester teaching. And what I found from looking at her course, and also just from trying to teach this stuff at San Francisco State University in a cultural diversity class, right, so it's broad cultural diversity, and so within that, we only get a little bit of time to talk about Indians and Indian issues. What people don't understand is that environmental issues intersect with tribal sovereignty, and so covering everything from tree-based hunting and fishing and gathering, rights and air and water quality issues, it's mining, it's tribal trust land and sacred site, this is all having to do with federal recognition. So there is this inherent connection between federal recognition and environmental issues on tribes. And so So even a case that's going through the Supreme Court right now, called Rakeem versus the Department of Interior, which is an Indian Child Welfare Act case. So has anybody been paying attention to this case in terms of the environmental possibilities of this? So.
Hello, can you hear me? Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and share with what the ESM is doing.
Where is this person coming from?
Next door.
And it's also a very really exciting time.
Let's see what that sounds like. They're from New Zealand.
I just did a story on the Wantowee River region in Arizona tribe called water issues.
Okay, well, I'll try to speak up and talk for this person. So, the Brakeen versus the Department of the Interior case, so again, it has to do with the Indian Child Welfare Act. But the Brakeens, the couple who has adopted a native child and is trying to keep that native child, which has to do with the Indian Child Welfare Act of 1974, they're being represented pro bono by Gibson Dunn. And so this firm has represented such companies as Chevron, Enbridge, and other fossil fuel industries, as well as the operator of the Dakota Access Pipeline. So what you have to understand is that this case has everything to do with environmental issues, because if they win, if the Rakeem cases, if they win their lawsuit, then that potentially affects tribal sovereignty across the nation. And so it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with Indian child welfare. It has everything to do with oil companies trying to dilute the rights of tribes in order to take the land, in order to get access to land that is currently under protection for tribal sovereignty. And so, again, we cannot separate the two issues. And so these are the things that journalism schools do not teach. I'm sorry, it's very hard to talk about this. There's this person in my ear. My ghost is talking to me. And so just some tips, right? I guess one of the main things is that tribes are not interchangeable. So we need to understand that what's happening, for instance, in the state of Virginia, and even in the tribe, the tidewaters of the tribes, for instance, my tribe, is not the same as what's happening in California. And so you cannot interchange tribal issues across the board. You have to be very specific to those tribes. And so that means basic reporting, doing your homework before starting to cover jobs. I know that sounds so simple, but so many people don't do the basic homework of just understanding the tribes that they are covering when they start doing the stories. And then look at indigenous media sources. There's a lot of them now. And even non-indigenous media sources like Deb, her reporting is amazing. And so, and I interview her extensively in the book. And you can learn a lot from just talking to another journalist about how to go about doing things. So I'm going to stop there because I don't feel like I'm not sure if you got anything that I said. But feel free to ask questions after. And again, I'm happy to talk to you about the book. And I'm selling it at my cost without royalties in order to get as many out as possible so that you understand what's happening. Thank you.
So next we're going to hear from Karina Dominguez, independent journalist. Karina, they said speak closely into the mic. So.
My name is Karina Dominguez. I'm from the Pascua-Yaqui tribe in Tucson, Arizona. And I'm, really excited to be here talking to you guys today because, journalism and, Native representation in journalism has been something I've just been very passionate about for a really long time. So I just want to start by, as a journalist, giving you guys a few tips that I think might be kind of helpful. I think when you're working with a tribe or, Native people, it's really important to understand time and resources. As you saw, I was a little late. A lot of tribes, they might not be so privy to getting you things exactly when you need them, you know, on the deadlines that you need them. So I think that is really essential to making sure you're kind of laying that groundwork before you actually, you know, need to hit that deadline, right? Giving yourself enough time to go in there and build those relationships. You know, oftentimes that takes trust, and you know that stuff's not built overnight. So those are two things I think would be, you know, most beneficial. And even if you're, you know, working for, you know, say a news organization, you're not able to actually physically go to this location. A lot of tribes, they do have, you know, issues with internet access. I used to work for Indian Country Today, and we launched a newscast during the COVID pandemic. And it was really hard because we did a lot of this reporting from our living rooms, and we did a lot of Zoom interviews, and a lot of times that was one of our biggest issues, is getting that connectivity. So just kind of being aware of, you know, the reservation, the tribe, the people that you're communicating with, you know, what those limitations might be, and trying to get ahead of those, or at least being aware of them, and making your editors and, you know, producers aware of that. The second part I was bringing up was, you know, building trust. I think a lot of that has to do with recognizing your own implicit bias, our own implicit biases. We all have them, you know. I don't know if anyone had a chance to kind of look through WOBA, but there was some recommended links I had posted to, if you want to take a look, you know, right now or afterwards. I really like to do, so I actually do a high school... Journalism.
Hi, my name is Christian Torres.
And with the high school journalism conference, very similar kind of conversations that we're having in this room right now.
Our headquarters are actually a couple minutes away from the Salton Sea and Dry City.
Just a brief comment. They said they're trying to resolve it. It's definitely a technical issue. We're just going to have to all talk really loud, I guess. So sorry, Karina. Keep going.
No worries, but if you have a chance, go ahead and check out that link. So Harvard did this study. It's actually a test, and you can kind of see how biased you are, and it'll give you a result. It kind of explains what that result is at the end. So when I do this with the high school journalism kids, they love, you know, to get interactive on their phones and, you know, scan the QR code, take this test. So maybe you can check it out now.
Can I ask you all to be quiet for a second? We're trying to see if the bleeding is still coming through, and we might be able to go here.
Testing, testing, 1, 2. Sounds good.
Yay! Thank you, sorry.
Okay. So, you know, as I was saying, you know, building trust with tribes is something that is just going to be difficult. You know, the history of genocide, the continued history of oppression, you know, people are very just skeptical, I guess you could say. They're very wary of, you know, those that they let in and the kind of knowledge that they share with those individuals as well. So that's just something to be cognizant of. And you know, if you have a bee, if you have a region that you cover, you know, just reach out when you don't have something that you need. You know, ask what's going on in the community. Just, you know, start to put your name out there so they get familiar with you. A lot of times you're going to have to go through tribal government, you know, to get the approval to do these stories. But I think one of the best ways you can start is by finding other Native journalists, you know, specifically from that tribe, or, you know, if you can't find somebody... there's always the Native American Journalists Association. They can probably put you in the right direction of someone. Or, you know, maybe a neighboring tribe that might have connections, might have just a network that they could kind of tap into to help you, you know, build on your sources and, you know, fact check and whatnot. So I would always encourage, you know, to try to partner with a Native journalist or, you know, even a photog or someone. Because a lot of times we're going to carry information that, you know, is really hard to just kind of get by asking someone questions, you know, things that you learn over your lifetime. And and things that, you know, you might not even really think of asking. So I think that would be a really great start. And, you know, like I was saying before we were interrupted, but with the implicit bias, you know, being aware of, you know, your own biases in your reporting, you know, words you choose to use, you know, things you choose to say. I think one of the most basic things I think, you know, a lot of journalists should know is just, you know, Native American, you know, very blanket term. I think most indigenous people prefer being called by their actual tribe. So making sure you get that tribal name right. And for example, you know, when I talk to people from the Navajo Nation, some of them say, I'm Navajo, and they're okay with the Navajo Nation. Some of them are more traditional, and they want you to know that. So they say, I'm Diné, which is their traditional way of saying that. And every tribe has, like, for example, mine is Baspayaki. Like, that's our colonizer name. But, you know, traditionally, we call ourselves Yueme. We're the Yueme people. And even more traditionally, even Hayaki. So there's different ways to identify. So I think letting that person know that you're aware of that and, you know, identifying them as they identify themselves, right? And so, you know, aside from that, you know, there are very basic differences as well. I don't know if you had a chance to look at those additional links that I was pointing you to, but one of them was the story that I did with Indian Country Today. And that was on climate change in the Sonoran Desert, and specifically the impacts it's having on the saguaro cactus group, which is harvested by the Tohono O'odham. I'm Baspayaki. The Tohono O'odham are the other tribe in Tucson. There's only two federally recognized tribes in Tucson. And, you know, I grew up there, and that's my hometown, and I grew up, you know, these were my neighbors, my neighbor tribe, my, you know, family members, friends, you know, people who are also from this tribe. But when I was doing research for that story, I learned a lot that I had never known growing up there, you know, being in the Sonoran Desert myself. And I got a lot of praise from the people who, you know, were sources in the story, but there was one thing that one of the main sources said, hey, you know, this isn't necessarily wrong, but, you know, it could have been more right, I guess. So the way they spell Baidaj, the saguaro cactus root, it varies from even within their own tribe. So there's the Tohono O'odham tribe, and then there's like the Salt River, Pima, Maricopa that are in the Phoenix area. Sister tribes, but they're different, both federally recognized separately. But same culture, sister tribes, they have the same culture, same language. But the thing that I wrote was the way I spelled Baidaj, I spelled it the way they spell it in Salt River. And most of my story and my reporting was in Tucson in the Tohono O'odham. So I didn't spell it with an H, which is how they spell it down here or down in Tucson. And so like just little tiny differences like that. You know, and that was something I thought, oh, I can look online and I can look and read these articles and I can find out myself without actually asking the source and, you know, thinking I'm bothering her too much and already asking a lot. And so I looked in their, you know, one of their tribal newspapers and I said, okay, this is how they spell it. But she said, no, that's how they spell it up there. So there's just such tiny little details that it's very easy to miss. So I think just, you know, not being afraid to ask again, double checking, and just being aware of those little details. So like she said, you know, doing the homework. But I'll leave it there, and I'll pass it on to this gentleman here.
Sorry. Now we're going to hear from Mr. Radley Daniels, who's he's on the ground advocating and protecting his tribal lands and waters. Mr. Davis.
Good morning, everyone. Chu Sun Li. I'm El Maui, Iligatke El Maui, Ma'ekpimi, Ma'amaidu, Ma'amiwak, Das Enjo Chi'i. I'm from up northeastern California. I'm enrolled with Pit River Tribe on my father's side. El Maui and Miwok and my mother. She's Ikpimi and Pig River is how to say it. That's Winneman, Wintu. And I've been helping in our community address the protection of sacred sites. And over the years, just got a lot of experiences. Preparing, like when I started out, when that voice came, I instantly put on my, I thought we were going to be protested. And I instantly could relate to that and just became defensive, like, okay, well, let's see what he's got to say, interrupting our session here. But it wasn't that. But I definitely thought that. I went into I reacted. But it's kind of like how we've been treated over the years. And one of the things about writing, the inherent bias that I can relate to my area of my people, there's an inherent bias because of how our people have been written. The last of the wild Indians, or like Ishii, is the person who was found in Oroville, California back in the early 1900s, and the last of the wild Indians, the Yana, the Yahi. It's not. But it's those types of writings then, over the years, and even of late, where we can be written out of history, and the history is rewritten. So I've learned that it's very important that writing is key. It's powerful. And in my time, it's been vital because of information getting out there. I was listening to the speakers here earlier, and it just got me thinking about, you know, other stuff here, about how education is important. I know that it's my view, but back in when Gray Davis was governor in California, there was these rolling blackouts, and we had been working with his staff on, and still are, in protest of geothermal mega extractive geothermal development up in northeastern California, Mount Shasta, in the volcanic caldera there. So we were working with his staff, who was interested in trying to figure out how to help us. We were going to work on some type of executive order that Davis was going to do, another loop, another barrier that developers would have to jump through. But these rolling blackouts were happening, and But our understanding is that the education was very, very effective by the governor, by that they were educating on reducing the use of energy. And that reduction collapsed the power grid. But of course, it got turned around in the media, and he was blamed. And I know there's a lot of other politics to it, but I know that he was going to run for president, but he got wiped out. He's voted out of being the governor, and Schwarzenegger became our governor. But we were learning quite fast about the high level of politics, and then how the developers and how these other entities were involved. Dick Cheney was the chair of this company that was the equipment that was doing geothermal development in our area. And so we, you know, he was, you know, we knew a lot about this involvement of the government with these contracts they're having. And of course, things going on in Iraq. So we had these whistleblowers that were providing us information, but it wasn't getting out to the public because we didn't, you know, we don't have a newspaper source with my tribe. We don't have no media folks. Look at my tribe right now. You're not going to find very much on just Googling your tribe. You're not going to find our dances on the internet. You're not going to find very much. It's just we just don't do it. It's just something we're not. Our people are into internet or that. And there's not much up in the mountains. Some people just don't have computers. You don't have Wi-Fi. If you're used to Wi-Fi, you're going up in my country, you're not going to be connected. but I know that the engagement of getting the story right is important. Even just recently, during the Trump administration, our area seems to be attacked by the raising of the dam, geothermal development, mega wind turbines in our eastern Shasta County because it's a poor community. It's out of sight, out of mind. But these are some of the areas we're battling. And one of them was these turbines that were proposed 4 years ago or so. And so while we were meeting a reporter who we all confided in, we knew the reporter, we felt like this was going to be a good article coming out. Granted that it was kind of good, but the thing that was wrong with it was the title, Natives versus Green Energy. And it created a conflict with the environmental groups in our community. They instantly just went with that, just that title, and the media that picked that up, that title, that was the excitement. It was the title. It didn't say community coming together, fighting what's right, because that's what we were doing. I mean, we wound up being, I was in a meeting, granted, I'm socially networked up, I got my Facebook, and all the stuff was controversy going on in the country, however you look at it, but the majority of the people in our public meetings were wearing their MAGA hats or Trump, and there was a lot of controversy in our community, like, well, if anybody's associated with them, we're not going to be part of it. But that wasn't our focus. We were really trying to figure out how we're going to fight this company. And they did not consult with the community, didn't consult with the tribe. And so we had to deal with the commissioners, who are the ones going to issue this permit on this private property. 30,000 acres, 72 wind turbines, 700 feet tall in a conifer forest in California. High fire area, already surrounded by the Carr fire, the Dixie fire, the Hertz fire, the Fawn fire. Those fires, 2 years ago, we were surrounded by fires, we were choked by smoke and COVID. And they still, CEQA, the people doing the draft environmental impact report that we were all trying to read, to over 2,000 pages, wouldn't extend the date for review. So all these things happening in the Intermountain area. And so we were trying to get media to jump on it, but because of that title, it really impacted our ability to try to work with people. And we never engaged before either. So I learned a lesson by these meetings of meeting with people who maybe politically that was happening and we wouldn't work together, but we rose above that. And so we're against these wind farms coming into our, cutting off mountaintops and mountain and ridges, and affecting not just the wildlife, the ecosystem, the water, and fire danger, which we were experiencing at the time. No way, we didn't want it. So we got together, and we had no attorney, and we fought them. And we went back to the person who reported that article. We told him to change his article. He has to. And he did, and it was successful. And we had a battle of that with the environmental groups who, we were not against green energy, we were against this particular system that was not good for our area for all these reasons. Which we didn't reveal. We did reveal a lot about the tribal part, about fasting. That's the other thing about reporting is the thinking the fried bread was 2,000 year old, all right, fried bread. It's something that's evolved. It's not from our way. There's a lot of misconceptions about us too, because we are reviving. Many tribes that's been mentioned here have been hit hard. Everyone's been hit in a different way by colonization, assimilation. Mentioned ICWA and boarding schools, it's all these different entities that have tried to erase us. So the revival, revitalization of our language, of our stories, of our relationship to the land, all these are still happening. But some of the people didn't know that. Many of our people still didn't know that or were experiencing this revival. And so the media, that became important to us. The environmental groups did come along in the very last week of 12 hours of testimony. We had to use the college in the local town because we packed the room. And by golly, we didn't know until they testified, the environmental groups joined us. You know, I think it was like a 5-4 vote on their boards. It wasn't unanimous, but they joined us, you know. And it was because of the burials upon the land, because of the fasting that we brought back for the women and the men, because of our understanding of not just the cosmology of the day sky and the night sky and how the mountains are connected, the volcanoes. We have two volcanoes in our community. The Ya'ako is Mount Shasta, Ye'techina is Mount Lassen. Two volcanoes, yes, and all the other mountains and waterways and all the things that are connected to it. We have songs and stories about it. There's no denying that. So, not that that was printed in the articles, but there was some sensitivity that we met some, in some way, some ways to help people understand who we are, and also us understanding our community and engaging in the process and having the reporters write that we have to work together to engage in the process because we don't know the process. And so we had to engage so that we could, not only did we defeat that one company, we also went back to the county and changed the a building code for the permitting process for the county code for large energy systems. We're not against energy systems. We're just against energy systems that could be in an area where it could not be good. So that was the thing that we had learned together and still are. And continue to battle because the developers are, they're sad because they got money. We believe just last year, Governor Newsom signed on June 30th, AB 205, a bill for anything over 50 megawatts. They can, the county, city, tribes, they have no say. They could come in and exercise their power to build whatever energy system they need to meet their quota for California. Look it up. We're battling the same company now because now it's a government overreach trying to still build the same project after they went through an in-depth CEQA, the environmental review process. So we're continuing to find, continuing to understand the language of every different layer that we have to. And we need writers, we need the folks that, people believe what they, a lot of people believe what they read. If we don't have anybody that's, can write a good story, it's tough because we experienced it, but I felt like our engagement and working with the journalists, the writers, the different newspapers in the region, one of the things I think that was mentioned here is like spending time with people. There was a really interesting experience of the rush, or the story's coming out tomorrow, I need a quote. Bradley, can I get one more quote? Because I interviewed the other side, and what do you think about this? I'm like, I don't know, I need more information. And so we advise them, they should take more time. Just like we're taking time with the land, we're taking time with each other, building a relationship. We're trying to protect an area. The same goes with people. We need to build a relationship, a long lasting relationship. And that takes time. Doesn't mean that we can't have a miracle overnight and have something happen, but relationships takes time. You're gonna get a better story. You're gonna get a better perspective and engagement by having a relationship with the people. And being careful about with some of the traditional spiritual people who might be wanting sizing you up. They may not tell you everything. They might just have you wait. I know a lot of, I know one reporter came and they were from the actual official newspaper and they couldn't eat anything. They weren't able to eat food, they weren't able to eat dinner. And one of the people caught their eyes like, hey, that person refused food. So I went to them and said, you know what, maybe accept it, you know, don't eat it. At least they see you accepting it. It's a way. And so they did, and guess what? They made friends that night with some of the elders. And we just continue to work with them about continuing, you know, being getting consent on especially the tribal, cultural, traditional pieces they may get, and just making sure they get consent on what they print. And the other thing too was about, a lot of us want to read what they wrote before it's printed, you know. Man, the journalist, of course, is just, man, that's a tough one, you know, but I respect it. But man, we, you know, it was, but they, but I really like that some of the different newspapers or the articles, they really gave us an education about who they work for, who their editor, and that was key. I really liked that. That was information that I needed. Now I respect it, but they would let me read something. Some people cut loose of some stuff, but I felt like that was the education to the journalists. It was like, you should talk about the history of your organization and or maybe your division and why you write this and what you're trying to achieve. That was very helpful to our community in getting trust with reporters. And also another experience a lot of reporters is the infighting maybe or the conflict within our tribal community that they've not ever experienced. Nobody would experience it unless you're in there. However they interpret that, they really, there's a turnoff, but it's kind of normal. You got to hang in there and not misinterpret that because you get you'll get some more valuable lessons about how the tribe has a communication about how they work things out to make decisions. I think I'll stop there. Just see what have our brother here close this up.
Thank you. Now we're going to hear from Mr. Dallas Cudgel, our final speaker.
Hano Ashte, Opida. Opida, Magaina, Opida, Mumbly Glace, the Opida. John, Chosen, Tioshpe, John Tewish Day, Tioshpe, Chosen. Much up in Dallas. My name is Dallas. I'm a father, a son, uncle, grandfather, neighbor, friend. Been working in both the host culture, the dominant culture, and my tribal culture for decades. And it's a hard bridge to be working in. So in talking about, you know, reporting and storytelling, you guys are all storytellers. So let me tell you a story. About a month ago, I had a dream. And I was dreaming. I'm not going to interpret your dreams either. And I'm going to give you a spirit animal. But I was dreaming, and it was Bob Dylan teaching an art class about Andy Warhol. And I don't know if you've seen that Andy Warhol with the Indian head. It's actually, the model was Russell, what's that guy's name? Russell Means. The Andy Warhol. And so then that used to hang in a coffee shop down here in downtown Boise. In Hyde Park, actually. When my twins are 14. When my little twins, they must have been four. And when I saw that Andy Warhol with Russell Means, that in, you know, Andy Warhol style, hanging there, like, Dad. And that was, you know, it was interesting because it was in the mainstream culture. That they saw somebody that in Boise, Idaho, which is what, 96% white, something maybe a little less nowadays. But they saw something in the mainstream culture that looked like them, or looked like my kids, my dad, my son was clear when he was born, but they saw something that looked like their dad. And that doesn't happen a lot, especially in Boise, Idaho, when I moved here in 1986. How do I interpret that dream? And I thought, well, maybe it's time for this, you know, the icons of America to, you know, maybe it's a rise of the indigenous folks, and icons of America are going to maybe sit in the back seat for a little while. So I'm hoping that's my interpretation. And I tell that story because if you're going to be an Indian country reporting, especially if you're talking to elders, you're going to get a story, a long story, and you're going to, you know, you're going to want that quote, right? But it might take half a day to get that quote out of that story. So you're going to need to be patient. And if they don't trust you because you haven't built the relationship, you might not get that quote like we just talked about. You might, they might just be like, our grandmas are really quiet. They run the whole show and they do like this. And then all the men vote the way they say. So, at least that's the way it is in Dakota. I'm Yankton Dakota, Sistan Wahpeton bands and clans. This is how we usually introduce ourselves, is who, where we come from. And so, I always tease my Lakota brothers and sisters. They were back a long time ago when you used to be Dakota. So it gets really confusing. So the Lakota Nation, we're called Sioux. My reservation is called the Fort Peck, Assiniboine, and Sioux Tribes. And so, Sioux, what does that mean? Nez Perce, what does that mean? Coeur d'Alene, there's a tribe in northern Idaho, Coeur d'Alene, what does that mean? Where do those words come from? They come from the French Jesuit priests who named us often. My friends here in Idaho, Shoshone, Bannocks, Paiutes, last name is Sam, Gibson, George. I don't think those were their names. Just like Ellis Island, you know, everybody, for one reason or another, changed their name. Or you're getting checked in and they didn't bother to get your name right. That's how it was with us in Indian country. So I tell that because building those relationships is really important. We're a slow culture, and we tell a lot of stories, and words are kind of a perilous gift, as we just learned. You get the wrong words on a headline, it's a problem. So building those relationships, building that trust, you know, we're still here, despite you know, efforts to get rid of us. And even though I use my language to introduce myself, my grandfather's a boarding school survivor. We're in northeastern corner of Montana, about 450 miles away over here by Great Falls, there's Fort Shaw. And he was sent to Fort Shaw. My grandmother's Assiniboine. They're not related to Dakotas. So we have two tribes on my reservation. They were similar language, similar dialect. My Lakota friends speak Lakota. They have different way of speaking. Just like if you come from Georgia, you don't sound like someone from Minnesota, but you're on the same nation. So that's kind of how Lakotas are. But there's 500 different tribes in the country, and on 360 some Indian reservations, and there's 500 different languages and ways of being. So my grandfather went to Fort Shaw. Well, he was kind of a tough guy. So about 3 months later, he was 12. They find him back in Poplar. So he escaped from Fort Shaw. But what happened was, all of us, cousin, his grandkids and my cousins, his grandpa teach us Dakota. That language, that won't do you any good. So I never did learn it. You know, I had to learn it later, and now that's a big thing on a lot of different places, is getting our language back. And so it's important, like we already heard, you know, it's different. Make sure you get the language right. So I'm rambling on here, but you know, I said like that words are a perilous gift, and so you guys have a big responsibility, you know, to get things right, to take that time, listen to that story, build those relationships. Yeah, we're coming away from some generational trauma, so we carry that, and that's important to know that. We're not going to trust just anybody walking onto our res and talking to us right away. And so the thing I'll leave you with is, so you get the background. It's like going to another country, right? If I was going to go to Kenya, I'm probably, as a reporter, I'm probably not going to know how to, you know, it might take me a couple years to build a relationship with the people over there. And it's kind of the same way going into Indian country, and you're going to 500 different places and that are different. I go back home, and you know, most of my cousins and everybody's about 2-3 inches taller than me. So the thing I'll leave you with is that we also carry some internal racism. We carry that. We have this imposter syndrome that, oh, well, you know, we don't need to be hurt. It doesn't matter. You haven't been listening to us for 500 years. So we carry that too. So sometimes you might run into that. And we work in a structure that is based on a colonial mindset and settlers. And that colonial mindset is a mindset of extraction, dominance over the natural world. You go into any tribe, I can almost guarantee it, the opposite of that mindset is going to be, you'll notice that right away, that we're a part of the natural world. We're not outside of the natural world or separate from it. So that's one of the things that environmental reporting is really key. Notice that we talk about our relatives with four legs and wings and roots and fins. We talk about them, you know, like that. Like they're our relatives. I'm working on some wolf things. The four-leggeds are my relative, and the four-leggeds are. The wolf holds a very spiritual, sacred place. So how many of you had a really easy time listening to us when that other voice was here? Okay, that's the structure that we live in. It's not easy. It's like listening, we're in a system, a colonial system, where there's this other person talking over us all the time. And that's the structure that we live in. And all of, when I look at the environmental regulations in this country and globally in some ways, everything is separated out. And so that structure is not good for the natural world to have everything separated out. In the same way, the wolves who are being killed in Idaho right now by the hundreds with open hunting, the structure that they live in is not, it's that colonial structure, and it doesn't work for them, because you pass a law and that allows anyone to go hunt and kill them at any time all year long. And so, but the Nez Perce tribe brought back the wolves in Idaho, and they managed the reintroduction program from 1995 to 2008. And brought back almost 2,000 wolves to the state. And so now we're down to about 1,000. And so, but what the Nez Perce tribe understood was that the wolf is a part of the an integral part of the natural world. You know, they needed to be here. Get rid of that disease in those elk herds and those expanded elk herds because of the Clearwater fires that came through and artificially elevated the elk herds. We needed the wolf for that. So, but then you get the Endangered Species Act that just deals with the species. And so when you go to a and reservation, as we just learned, it's like we're kind of all about the overall health of the ecological system. That's not the ecosystem, that's a different thing. The whole ecological system of which the two-leggeds are a part of. And so that's the context. So here's that ad that we just took out in the newspaper about the wolf killings. Because there's an Endangered Species Act, yes, there's some ecological considerations and some science-based whatnot in the Endangered Species Act, but we're looking at one species. We're not looking at the overall ecological health. So we're gonna ask, hopefully, Secretary Holland to do an emergency relisting of the wolves to help bring back the wolves and create balance in that ecological system in the wild areas of Idaho. I'll leave it there.
Okay, thank you. The zip in my language, the zip. So Karina wants to kind of summarize some of the points that we've heard. So she's going to talk briefly, and we're going to have to really get through the questions fast. If you're going to do your lead-ins, no more than 10 seconds, so we can get as many people as possible. But go ahead, Karina.
And I just wanted to tie together a few points that these other panelists made here. Journalism can be a very extractive industry. You know, you come in here, you need something really fast. You could be slow to respond when they need something in return. So I think just kind of being aware of that and making sure that you're not appropriating cultures in your reporting. And that was kind of why I kind of told you guys to take a look at that test to kind of, you know, gauge your own bias. And I would even encourage you to take it a step farther and like kind of do like a self-audit, you know, and look at who are you talking to for your stories? You know, what kind of backgrounds do they come from? Are you getting a diverse group of people from, you know, diverse communities, you know, women, men, you know, every kind of, you know, intersection that you could think of. So just kind of being aware of that. And, you know, the words that you use, like, for example, you know, at Indian Country Today, when I was working over there, we were very cognizant of how we were describing people. Like, these people aren't just at the North Dakota Access Pipeline. You know, they're not protesters. They're land defenders. They're water defenders. These are people who are putting their bodies on the line, you know, their safety, their lives on the line, really, to protect these, you know, very sacred and important resources that we have. So just being aware of that, the context that you use, you know, things, and trying to stay away from, you know, stereotypes and racist tropes. And, you know, I think the self-audits can help you kind of just diversify, you know, your own sources. And, you know, when you think about covering these stories, yeah, I know you guys are all environmental journalists, but even, you know, talk to your newsrooms about it, because tribal governments are exactly that. They're governments. So you have your federal government, your state government, your local government, your municipalities. You guys cover these stories, right? But how often are you actually covering tribal governments and what's going on there? You know, that needs to be, you know, just as important as state and federal government as well. Because these are federal lands that, you know, they're occupying. And aside from that, I just wanted to bring up another point. You know, we're talking about extraction. And green energy, as he had said, you know, natives versus green energy. Last year, this exact same time, and actually right now it's happening, the United Nations, they have something called the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues that's happening right now in the UN headquarters in New York City. So, you know, being there last year, I got to meet tribal leaders, indigenous people from all around the world, and everyone had the exact same concerns. Extraction. You know, green energy, you know, what does that entail? Lithium, you know, 30 by 30, yeah. So, you know, a lot of the concerns that people had, these indigenous folks, you know, it has to do with extraction, it has to do with, you know, how do we find a balance? And really what it comes down to, it's like, we're not just talking about environmental journalism here, we're talking about politics, we're talking about economies, we're talking about all these different things and how they're intertwined. And, you know, environmental justice, you know, a lot of the justice part of it comes from extraction and capitalism. And I think a lot of times in people's reporting, they're afraid to bring these things up because this isn't a biased thing, this or that. Indigenous people see it very clear cut as capitalism is a direct result of, you know, climate change is a direct result of climate, of capitalism, sorry. And so I think just kind of being aware of these things in your reporting and not being afraid to ask these questions, especially when you have a source who's a policymaker, someone like that, don't be afraid to press these issues because, you know, there's so many layers of trauma, there's so many layers of different issues going on here, and they all are kind of interrelated. And, you know, kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier with ICWA and boarding schools, you know, many people are currently being stolen right now. This was historically happening, it's happening now. So there's just layers of trauma that you have to understand too when you're approaching a Native person, a Native community, and all these different factors that are taking place all at once. It can be very detrimental to people, and I think, you know, making sure that you're aware of these things and, you know, because when we're stealing children, you know, currently, and, you know, you're really stealing tribal culture, you're stealing language, you're stealing tribal sovereignty, you know, and these things are important for protecting the land, for protecting the water. And so I'll just leave it right there. And I just wanted to make one more point too. He said something about, you know, making sure that you have permission, you know, like don't go in there and just start recording photos and videos. Make sure you have explicit permission to do that. And make sure you're getting it from the right people too.
Thank you, Karina. We're going to open this up for questions, but just really briefly, the American Journalism Association has some really great tip sheets. My personal favorite is how to find an Indigenous expert. It is snarky, but it's real. So, as always, SPG members get first shot. Please, please keep your lead in to about 10 seconds because they tell us we have to be done by noon. So, okay, who raised their hand first? Get over here. Yeah, and then over there, and then, yeah.
Keeping it really quick, is there potential for it to be seen as disrespectful for it, non-Native?
I forgot to tell your name and your outlet.
I'm Allison Davis. I work for the Environmental and Energy Study Institute. Is there potential for it to be seen as disrespectful for non-Native journalists to use the term Indian country?
I think it's different if it's disrespectful for non-Native journalists to use the word Indian country. So I'll just let you know, I work for Indian country today. And I think the older generation really doesn't see too much of an issue using Indian. The younger folks really want to stay away from that. They see it as inaccurate and, you know, many different things. I think it's kind of safe. I think Indigenous is the safest way if you're going to use like a more blanket term. That's what I prefer. But every individual is going to have their own preferences. And I think as long as, you know, you're talking about a specific tribe and you use that tribe's name, you know, that's really the safest bet.
Yeah. I use Indian country all the time because it is a federal designation. So, but again, it's really important. Find out what the person wants to be called. Some people really don't like to be called Indian, or they don't want to be American Indian, and they don't want to be Native, they want to be Indigenous. Best practice is find out what their tribal affiliation is. Just use that. Okay, next. Oh, wait a minute. I think it's over here. Yeah, over there. Over there. Sorry, I'm using my fingers. Grandma said not to use fingers, but yeah. In the back. Raise your hand high so she can get to you.
Whatever. Sorry, I raise your hand high. Hi, I'm Erin Rohde with the Desert Sun in Palm Springs. So I'm curious, this has all been really helpful, but for those of us that are at, you know, legacy news outlets that have a long history of pretty bad coverage of tribes, I guess I'm curious of any advice for both individuals who are coming into that setting of, like, there's already an existing long and also even recent history of coverage, like, Natives versus green energy in our newsrooms, as well as, like, any examples of newsrooms that have done a good job of like reckoning with that and acknowledging that past harm through their news coverage?
So I used to work for CBS Television Network. That was my first job out of college. I was working for Sunday Morning. Some of you guys might know that show. The Weekend News on the Evenings. You know, big legacy media, as you said. And when I was there, you know, I had access to EMPS, and that gave me access to all of the different shows, the evening shows, the morning shows. And so what I did when I was there, not an environmental story, but it was the Cleveland Indians. They had decided to get rid of that Chief Wahoo mascot, right? So I do a quick little Cleveland Indian search on EMPS just to see how they've been reporting on this issue before. And not surprised to find what I found, right? Racist, stereotypes, all of this. At this point, I was mainly working at Sunday Morning. This is not the kind of story Sunday Morning would typically cover. But they had covered, you know, this team in the past, and they had said racist things in the past. And so I brought it up to Rand, who is the executive producer there. And, you know, a lot of times I think you can bring things up and it might fall on deaf ears, but I think as long as you're bringing these things up, so what I did was I went through, I printed all these scripts from back in the 90s. Printed scripts, you know, was looking at all the different ways. But more recently, you know, I could see like a very clear difference between the way the morning writers were talking about this issue versus the evening writers, where it was a little more salacious and like, you better go get your gear now before it's all gone. Where like the morning writers were a little more just kind of putting the facts out there, but all of them really missed the facts of the story, which is, you know, there has been scientific research done on this. The American Psychological Association has come out with recommendations since the early 2000s saying Native mascots have detrimental impacts on Native people, specifically the youth when they're building their identity, when they're you know, taking hits to their self-esteem. All of these things matter, and none of the reporting mentioned that. So I think if you can find in your legacy media different ways that they've kind of screwed up and highlight those and bring it up to the people, they might not change it. But as long as you do your research and you say, hey, you know, you're missing X, Y, and Z from the story, you know, maybe next time they'll be more aware. But just being persistent, I guess.
Here's how I'd answer that. And thank you, I think that's really good. This is the one thing I didn't say, and it was in my notes, is that we tell all these stories, and you know, it takes a long time, and we need to build those relationships. Words are a perilous gift. Sometimes our answers in Native country are no, or yes, or we don't answer. So sometimes we're not really polite. It's a super polite culture, if you're in it. If you're not in it, we may feel really rude and not polite, and that's okay, because, you know, we have some background and some history that makes sense. And so that's the preface to say we have this colonial structure, which is racist based. I think most of us might not always agree with that, but when you're in a brown skin body, that's how you feel. So racism is not our problem. It's a white problem. It's a white person's problem. So these legacy media outlets, I'm not going to help you clean up your closet. So we need white allies, and you can look it up online. There's all kinds of ways to be a white ally. We need white allies to step up, because I'm done providing my emotional labor. So that's another way to answer that. That might not seem polite, but I don't really apologize for that anymore, because I'm almost an elder.
I am an elder, so. But my answer to all of those is that the nation has eliminated offensive mascots from other communities. When African Americans said Little Black Sambo is offensive, they got rid of it. When Hispanic people said the Frito Bandito is offensive, they got rid of it. So it's really a question of equity. I'm just doing the mascot thing really fast. So when Native people say something's offensive, why are people resistant? these are questions that, that journalists can and should be asking, even if you're environmental journalists. But I mean, it's along these same lines. It's an equity issue. And basically, yeah, I'll take my journalist hat off for a minute. You know, when I was in high school, I was told, because everyone knew who the Malone Indians were, told me to stay in school and not get pregnant like all the rest of the Indian kids did. You know, the girls were all getting pregnant in barefoot in high school and dropping, and they said, you should stay in school and get one of those really good jobs, Deb. You could be a secretary. Talk about inherent bias. So I've been pretty sensitive to that all my life. But working at the Arizona Republic, you know, we have Greg, we have Sean McKinnon. Both of them have worked in Indian country for years and years, and they recognized pretty early on that the Republic hadn't been doing really what it should be. And rather than apologize for the past, they just said, we're just not going to do this anymore. Our coverage is going to be culturally appropriate, culturally sensitive, and they brought people on who know the communities and do it. So my advice to you all is, if you're in a big legacy media operation and you see an opening, you know, encourage an Indigenous person to go for it, because we can be sources and we can be helpful to other reporters. So anyways, I'm done with that now. We have time for one more question.
My name is Devin Farbelo, and I'm the graduate assistant at the Center for Environmental Journalism at CU Boulder. I am really interested in hearing about how we can center Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous science in our science writing, and how to do that without, like, kind of the drop-in journalism. I know you talked about building relationships, but yeah, can we elaborate on that?
I think I kind of understand it. I remember an elder provided this in-depth breakdown of history of colonization in our homelands, and the in-depth context and insight. It's like a long time, hours and hours, just detail. It's very enlightening for all of us that were in the room. And then the reporter only extricated what was the most controversial soundbite, not the context. And so they missed it. You know, it's like another example of this. Just really wanted to get the controversial, but there was that. So, taking time, and it's also good to know someone in the Indian community who may not be your source, that you could run it by, give you another objective that's not maybe necessarily about your story. That's part of the relationship building as well.
I just want to add, hopefully you can hear me, when I was doing research for this book, I looked at 40 years worth of coverage of federal recognition. And the thing that I found from 40 years ago up till now is that it was never the tribe's story. It was always the reporter's story. The reporter always went in. It was very obvious from a Native perspective that the reporter always went in with a story that they wanted to tell. And they weren't telling the story that was coming from the tribe. And so that's why even tribes who didn't want casinos for federal recognition, that word was in there like 70% of the time. And so I think that's like, be humble, right? As we're taught in journalism school to be humble, to not know anything, to go asking for information, to get the story from that perspective, but we go in with an idea of what that story is. And sometimes you have to remember that you submit your story and then your editor says, well, why isn't there a casino in the story? And so it's your job to fight for that and fight for the story. That's the actual story. That's the truth of the people whose truth you're trying to tell.
Well, folks, I wish we had more time, and I wish we hadn't been interrupted, but We're all going to be around, so come see us the rest of the day. Make sure you get to the afternoon plenary, because I'm sure a few of these people are going to have some really pointy questions for the federal officials. So be sure you're there for that.